What is up, Vermont Edition podcast listener? This is Elodie Reed, digital producer for VPR. Just to let you know, this podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. By mid-July, many Vermonters are reaping the bounty of our short growing season and eating locally by just taking a few steps out to their garden beds or containers. The farm stands and grocery stores are starting to show off beautiful tomatoes, salad cukes, and peppers. But others among us are finding the heads have been bitten off our pepper plants and eggplants, or maybe that's just my garden. And chipmunks are digging holes in your raised beds, or blight has appeared, striking fear in a gardener's heart. Whatever your gardening issue, or even if you just want to brag about your Victory Garden's success this year, it's time to share. We're going to be talking gardening all this hour on Vermont Edition, and we're joined, as usual, by Charlie Nardozzi, gardening expert and contributor to All Things Gardening on Sunday mornings at 9:35 here on VPR. Hi, Charlie. Nice to talk with you, although I can't see you today.
Hi, Jane. I'm imagining your face.
I'm sure that's a wonderful image for you. Are you not just imagining, but can you actually see some of your garden handiwork from where you're sitting in your house right now?
Actually, I'm sitting in my office. So unless I turned the computer on and looked at some slides, no, I cannot see what's going on.
What is actually ripening or blooming or blossoming right now in your garden?
Well, lots of stuff. You know, it's been a really nice year so far for the roses. I don't know if you have any roses, but ours.
As you know, Charlie, I have had a rose and it is the bane of my existence and I am still trying to get rid of it. So thank you very much.
Not to poke a little
bit.
Yeah,
really.
There, but the roses have done very well in our garden. I think they like the heat. They like the sun. They've had enough water that they haven't been showing signs of drought and heat stress. And they've been blooming their little heads off. So, yes, the roses that we like are doing well in our garden. There are some roses that are invasive that also have been doing well. I've been noticing those in fields, too.
So in my garden, which, you know, I plant some things from seed, but mostly pick up seedlings for things like tomatoes. We've got tomatoes that are green, not quite ripe yet. We've got a purple pepper that's looking pretty purple, not quite mm-hmm. there yet, but looking great. This year I grew more squashes, so it's been really fun to see the summer squash blossoms and now those little summer squashes and zucchinis starting to get ready and the pickling cuke. I always grow at least one pickling cucumber, and every year I'm like, this is the year I'm going to be on top of it. I'm going to pick it every time there's a cucumber just at the right stage, and mm-hmm. it always gets away from me. I don't know how those cucumber plants do it, but they are just like, they have a way of growing cucumbers that you go out in the morning, and it's the perfect size for pickling, and you come back in the afternoon, and it's gargantuan. I don't know how that happens, Charlie, but it happens to me every single year.
They grow as fast as your kids. That's
kind of
right. How it
faster.
Works. Well, maybe even a little faster. Yes. That is a good point, though. Any of the summer squash, zucchini, cucumbers, beans, as they start coming in, it's important during this hot weather to stay on top of the harvesting because things will get pushed along really quickly here. And the idea is that you pick them when they're small, like a zucchini, for example. I pick them with the flower attached often. Pickling cucumbers, you know, 3 or 4 inches long, slicers can be a little bit longer, and beans before they form the little bean inside, so they're nice and smooth along their surface. If you can keep up on that harvesting, you'll get really tender, delicious produce, and it'll continue to keep producing. If you let any of those go to those big gargantuan ones that you were talking about, then it produces mature seed that sends a message back to the plant that, oop, my work's done, see you later, I'm done, I'm not going to produce so much anymore.
So even if you just need to pick and then, you know, as the saying goes, throw some zucchini into your neighbor's car or something, that's a better idea if you're actually hoping to have the plant keep producing on into the summer?
Yes, exactly. Even if you're just going to compost it. I mean, it's better to pick it than leave it there and get really large because that's going to send the wrong message, you might say, back to the squash plant.
All right, listeners, what about for you? What are you growing? What is ripening right now? And what is vexing you in your garden? You can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org. Anything new you're growing this year that has you really excited, Charlie?
Well, I had my first taste of green chickpeas this year that I'm growing.
Ooh, cool.
So chickpeas or garbanzo beans are something that we traditionally don't grow here because they need a long season to get to that mature stage. which is what we normally eat. We're eating like a mature pea or a mature bean at that stage. But if you go to any Indian restaurants or Indian grocery stores, you'll often see a whole little package of these green chickpeas, meaning that they harvest them when they're green. They fill out a pod and you peel the skin away. And inside is kind of a wrinkled version of the brown one that would happen later, but it's green. And you eat it fresh, like you would a fresh shelling pea. So we had a little snack of those this morning. It was kind of fun.
Charlie.
You're not excited, I could tell.
No, I actually think that sounds amazing. I would love to try that. You and I have talked in the past about cucamelons or Mexican gherkins, and I've grown some of those from seed. So those are just starting for me. We were late in planting some of our seeds this year, but I'm looking forward to having – somebody else once wrote into one of our gardening shows here that they call them Barbie watermelons because they look like they're about the size of a Barbie doll, you know, what a Barbie doll watermelon would look like. And they look like watermelons, but they're little cucumbers. And I love pickling them because I think they look so pretty in the jars.
Yes, yes, they're really nice. And you bring up a good point. It's not too late to plant a lot of things. We're having a real hot summer, if you haven't noticed. Mm-hmm. As long as this heat continues, which it looks like it's going to, you can still be putting in squash and beans and cucumbers and cucamelons because they'll mature later, of course, and you're going to have to stay on top of the pests because these young plants coming out of the ground are just delicious little treats for a lot of insects and other kinds of pests. But if you stay on top of that, you can have a late crop of all of these things.
Anything you don't want to plant right now when it's super hot but that you could plant later on into the fall?
Yeah, any of the cool season things like peas, for example. You can do a fall crop of peas, but you're not going to plant that till more towards the end of July or early August. Leafy greens like lettuces and spinach, you're probably going to wait on those so it gets a little bit cooler. But you could plant things like Swiss chard. Swiss chard has a lot more heat tolerance, and certainly collard greens would grow well in this temperatures.
So, Charlie, if I have a friend, say, who didn't get their peas in, their snap peas in time and planted them a couple weeks ago, is she going to have a problem? Like maybe planted them a week and a half ago.
Yeah, they're going to come up. That's a good thing. They'll grow. They may not form peas that are very good if they get that far along at all. So you could hope for cooler weather.
That's my friend, you mean? My friend could do this.
Your friend should hope. Your friend should hope for cooler weather. You could try shading them a little bit, or your friend could try shading them a little bit, especially from the afternoon sun. That might help keep them a little cool, keep them well watered. And you never know, you know, with fingers crossed, you might get a few peas. But I think your friend should really think about maybe doing it again, like in July, early August, and see what happens.
Got it. All right. Well, I'm not the only one with problems. And you mentioned pests a moment ago, and I'm glad you did because it will come as no surprise to you, Charlie, that we have a lot of listeners who are dealing with some pests and could use your assistance and advice. Dorigan and Johnson says, our shell beans and Romano bean plants look terrible, crumpled, yellowed, and in extreme cases, completely brown and shriveled. When shaken, small, light green flies leave the plants. I assume these are white flies. Do you have advice to rid ourselves of these?
Yes, they could very well be white flies that attack that plant. I'm not sure they may be the sole cause of the damage and why the plants aren't doing very well. But certainly, if the plants look like they're dead, which sounds very much like how she described them, I would just pull them out or cut them down and clean them out. There's no need to hold on to them at that point and replant. As I was mentioning, it's plenty of time to replant things like bush beans or Romano beans. And as far as the white flies go, they like the heat. They like a lot of the conditions we're getting here. So you want to keep an eye out for them. Check the undersides of the leaves. That's probably the one thing. If you're going to look for insects, look on the undersides. That's where a lot of the eggs happen. That's where a lot of the larvae hang out. It's really a good camouflaging technique that they have by being underneath the leaf. Look under there. As soon as you see some signs of them, then you can do some sprays of something simple like an insecticidal soap, and that should take care of them.
Okay. And so the white flies that you're talking about, are they actually light green in color? Because that's what Dorigan is noticing.
Yeah, they could be light green in color. Usually they're white, of course, and why we call them white flies. But light green in color is a possibility too. But I'm thinking that it may be a combination of some insect attack. It could be something to do with the root system. It could be a lot to do with the weather, the heat and the drought that we've been having.
So speaking of which, Margie wrote in and we were talking about things that you might want to hold off on planting. And you mentioned leafy greens. But Margie says, I want to have leafy greens all summer, but I can't get salad greens to start when it's this hot. What to do?
Yeah, so you could look for some varieties. For example, with lettuce, there are some varieties like Heat Wave and Summertime. And some of the loose leaf varieties, even Black Seeded Simpson, an old variety, they'll do better in the heat than a regular heading romaine lettuce or a heading soft headed lettuce, because you're picking individual leaves. So I would do something like that. I would do a mix too. You know, there's a lot of salad green mixes out there, especially ones that you're going to pick them as baby greens. So when they're small and they only have maybe 4 to 6 leaves on them, because you can get those to come up and grow pretty well. And then you'll be harvesting them before the heat and all of the insects and everything kind of gets on top of the situation. So those would be some of the things I would try if you really want to have salad greens. And if you're trying to protect those greens, the micro mesh covers that I've been using are really nice. They're kind of like a floating row cover, but they're made out of a kind of a flexible window screen material. And you can just lay them over the plants or over some hoops over the plants and anchor them down around the sides. And they block insects from coming in and laying eggs and causing the damage you often see.
Okay, good advice. Another pest, but of a different sort, is one that Kathy would like some help with. Kathy's in Orwell and says, wondering if you have any good techniques to rid the land of stinging nettle. I have been naturalizing the property with native wildflowers instead of mowing lawn. I don't use harmful herbicides like Roundup. One section in particular has been a real bear to clear because of the stinging nettle.
Well, stinging nettles, I'll just throw this out there. She may not want to hear this, but they're delicious. We make soups out of them every spring. I have a patch in our garden, our vegetable garden, of stinging nettles. I kind of keep it contained by just, you know, mulching around it and making sure it stays in a little area. And every year we harvest the tops of them. And we, of course, when you cook them, it loses the sting. They're high in vitamins, minerals. I'm just doing a whole pitch here for stinging nettles. They're really delicious, too. Make a great green soup, and they're medicinal as well. But that's not going to solve Kathy's problem. If she has it spreading, which stinging nettles will do, if it's possible to mow that area, maybe you'll sacrifice some other things and mow it a little more frequently to weaken the plants. That will help. And then other than that, the only other solution would be really to kind of dig them out. I mean, that would be happening in the spring when they first come out of the ground. Try to dig them out, get as much of the root system as possible, and try to have some more aggressive natives in there. So hopefully they can overgrow those areas where the stinging nettles are.
Yes. And you know, I think I'm going to steal a phrase from Joe Roman, though. If you can't beat them, eat them. That seems to be a good approach to some things.
It is. Or get some friends over who love stinging nettles and just have them constantly harvest them, and you eventually wipe out the plant.
Alice in Rutland has a question about spider mites, saying, they've decimated all my garden phlocks. They were fine, and within a week they were dead, covered by the distinctive spider mite webbing. I've never seen this before. I cut the dead plants out, but what about all the plants around those phlocks? I don't see spider mite evidence on anything yet. Are they still lurking there? How do I make sure the other plants stay healthy and those darn mites are gone for good?
You say these questions like you're narrating a movie.
I try to bring life to the questions that we read.
I love it, Jane. You're doing a great job. Yes, spider mites are out there, and they continue to be out there because it's been hot and it's been dry, and that is spider mite weather. And unless something's going to be changing in the near future, that's the kind of weather we've been getting. So I'm sorry about the flocks and dying back, but that is something that'll happen. Once you see the webbing of the spider mites, it's usually too late. By then, the mite population has exploded, and they're all over the place, and they can, you know, wipe out plants. Now, those flocks, the perennial flocks, I'm assuming she's talking about, they'll come back next year, so don't worry about that. They're pretty hardy plants. As far as the other plants, it's good that she's checking. You know, check for any signs of mites around there, which will be a little stippling in the leaves. Again, look on the undersides of the leaves. And one thing you can do is to try to keep the humidity up. So right now, it's pretty humid out there. And if, as long as the humidity stays around, that is not a condition that spider mites like. They like it drier. So if you can make sure you're watering well, misting the leaves of the plants. I know normally we don't try to do too much of that because of other diseases. But in this case, it would be good to do that in the mornings. Keep the plants nice and moist. Those are going to create conditions that the spider mites don't like. If you start seeing little signs of them here and there, insecticidal soap that I mentioned earlier in the show should be an easy solution and a safe one.
All right, let's go to Tim, who's calling in from Westmore. Hi, Tim. Go right ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Charlie, I had a couple of questions about my lilacs. They're done blooming, and I'm wondering, should I be cutting off those blooms? I don't think I have in the past, but it seemed like in the spring when I started to look at them that maybe I should have done that. I don't know.
Yeah, so if you have the lilacs and they've bloomed before, I mean, it's always a good idea to deadhead them or remove those flowers when they're done. That's just going to be better for the plant, so it's not spending all its energy into creating seeds, which is what those dead flowers are turning into, and more energy into creating more blooms for you next year. If it's not practical to do that, it's probably okay to leave them up there, especially on the species, the Syringa vulgaris, those types, because they're very aggressive plants. And so having some dead blossoms on them really won't hurt them. If you have some of the more refined hybrids, it's probably a good idea to always do it because they're not as aggressive and not as strong. So the bottom line is, yes, go ahead and cut them back off.
And Tim, you told Lydia, our call screener, that one of your lilacs didn't even bloom this year.
Yeah, there were a couple of them that didn't bloom at all. I kept waiting and waiting, and they just never bloomed. And it got me thinking, wow, maybe I should have fertilized, you know, last fall or maybe this spring, and I didn't do that either.
Yeah, Tim, you're speaking my language. Charlie, what about it?
Well, lilacs not blooming could be due to a number of things. The primary one is not enough sun. So I don't know, Tim, if they're in full sun or if they're in a place where they're getting some shade. But if they don't get enough sunlight, they don't set their flower buds, which they're doing now, by the way. They start in July and August setting the flower buds for next year. So that's why you don't want to be doing too much pruning on them other than the deadheading, because you don't want to remove flower buds that are on there. So that's another number two would be if you pruned late last year for whatever reason, especially just kind of the tops of the branches, you might have been removing some of those flower buds that didn't happen this spring. So I would take a look at those two things and see if there's anything you can do. Certainly adding fertilizer, a compost around the plant or an organic fertilizer wouldn't hurt. But usually that's not going to be the determining factor as far as whether they flower or not.
Let's go to Isabel, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Isabel. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. I would like to ask about the hemlock adelgid. That's an insect that eats the needles of hemlock trees. And I have six beautiful hemlocks that are infested. So out of the blue this spring, several weeks before the drought, I noticed the tiny white adelgid eggs on the lower branches and the trees losing their needles on the lower branches. So I would like to ask, I think I was told this is pretty much a death sentence for the tree, but is there anything that can be done to slow down the course of destruction by this awful insect?
Isabel, thanks for the call. Charlie, what do you think?
Well, I'm sorry to hear about that. I know that the woolly adelgid has been noted in Bennington County, but I guess now in Brattleboro as well. It is a devastating insect on hemlock trees, and I'm not sure, depending upon the severity of your infestation, if there is hope for having that tree survive. I would suggest contacting a local arborist because they're really well versed in this insect. Many of them are because it has been on the radar for a number of years now as something that we have to kind of watch out for. And see if there is some way that they can treat the tree to save them and maybe knock back the woolly adelgid. As far as I understand, it hasn't been spreading that quickly, which is nice. I know folks like myself up in the northern part of the state haven't had to worry about it at this point. But I know in the southern part of the states and places bordering Massachusetts and New York, that's where you're starting to see it. So I think that would probably be the best thing is to contact a local arborist and see if we can get a good opinion.
Yeah, it is a problem. You can look at Vermont Invasive's website. You can also look at Forest Parks and Recreation for more information and what landowners can do to at least keep an eye on hemlock woolly adelgid and to see where it's already been confirmed to have spread in southern Vermont. We got a note from Sherry who says, cucumber beetles are causing damage to my cucumbers and zucchini. I've been spraying neem oil, but I still have cucumber beetles and their damage. I've also sprinkled Captain Jack's dead bugs. Are these products harmful to bees? If so, what is effective to repel cucumber beetles? And are these products harmful for people who breathe in the powder or mist when spraying?
Yes, so cucumber beetles, they are out there. They're attacking, as she said, many different plants. Probably one of the best ways to control them or at least reduce their population is use what I call the yellow sticky traps. And these are yellow cards that you hang kind of right above the cucumber plants. And they naturally have this sticky substance, it's called tanglefoot, that's on. It's kind of like a Vaseline. So when the cucumber beetle is attracted to the yellow card because of the color, they like the color yellow, thinking it's a big flower, hit the jackpot. They fly in, they land on the card, and they get stuck, and then they die. So it's not going to control all of the cucumber beetles, but it will help for sure. As far as sprays go, the neem oil is kind of hit and miss in my experience with different insects. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. So I'm not too surprised she didn't get a real positive response from that. The Captain Jack dead bug spray is spinosad. That's the active ingredient. That is a bacteria that attacks a number of different insects. It's kind of a broad spectrum spray, meaning that it kills a number of different types of insects, from asparagus beetles to cucumber beetles to Japanese beetles, all kinds of things. But it also does harm honeybees. So it is something you have to be very careful with using. If you are going to try to use it, you want to do it early in the morning or late in the evening when the bees are not active. My understanding is once it's dried, it's not as toxic. But it would be tough to spray that now because there's so many flowers out there on squashes and cucumbers. The bees are flying all over the place. So unless you're really in dire straits, I would not use that product. I would try some of the trapping methods and see if that helps.
And is this similar for squash bugs, too, if you've got squash bugs?
Yes, same thing with squash bugs. The key with squash bug control, though, is right now, this time of year, is to flip over those leaves again and look for the copper-colored eggs. Often they're laid in groups or in lines. They're very linear insect. I'm not sure why. But they lay their eggs in little lines, and you can see them. They're very obvious. When you flip over a zucchini leaf or a melon leaf or a pumpkin leaf, you'll see them there. And if you either can squish them with your hands or some people actually take some duct tape and roll it around their hands and just pat it on where the eggs are, and it lifts the eggs right off the leaf. Kind of cool, huh?
Mm-hmm.
But if you can stay on top of that, especially if you only have a few plants here and there and do it every day or two, you'll be able to reduce that whole population dramatically, meaning that by August and September, when the population of squash bugs can explode, you've had them under control for a while. And that way you don't have to do any sprays or any of the other types of things that might be harmful to other creatures.
Those copper eggs, which I've been seeing this year on our squash, are so beautiful. And I'm going to admit something that I may regret, but it's really kind of satisfying to squish those eggs, Charlie.
It is very satisfying. I love going through there, just rubbing them between my thumb and finger.
We've got some updates and advice and thoughts from people as well. Let's go to Joyce, who's calling in from Sunapee, New Hampshire. Hi, Joyce. Go right ahead.
Hi. I used to run a certified organic farm in Massachusetts. And I always have gotten, and I'm a botanist, I have a master's degree in botany, and I've always gotten a lot of questions from people like one of your callers. They want some kind of lettuce greens during the summer. And a lot of people don't know about the wonderful group of lettuces called Batavian summer crisp lettuces. There's a number of different varieties of them, and they are specifically, they can be grown in the spring just like regular lettuces. But they also will tolerate the heat and the longer day lengths, because a lot of your lettuces are they're short day plants. So when you get to the longer days, they bolt, and especially then with the heat. The other type of the variety of Sierra, I've grown these things. They look like flowers. You know, they'll be a foot in diameter. And what you can do is you can harvest. You don't need many plants because you can harvest your outer leaves, which are not bitter, and then the center will just keep growing onwards.
Well, that is so cool, Joyce, and you know, interesting to pair with what Charlie was saying about harvesting the leaves and doing that sort of outer harvesting. Thank you for that advice and that suggestion. Charlie, we also have an update from a listener that I was really excited to get, and you might be interested to hear. Deb says, I wrote in last fall about growing tomatoes indoors under grow lights, and Charlie addressed my comment on air. I wanted to give you an update. We planted 2 red robin tomatoes in self-watering containers in early September and grew them under our grow lights. We began harvesting tomatoes in early December. We had a steady supply until the end of March. As Charlie noted, they did not have that sun-ripened special taste, but they were certainly better than the ones available in grocery stores at that time of year. On March 15th, we then planted bush beans in containers and began picking them on May 2nd. We moved them outside when the weather warmed and are just now picking the last. Since our outdoor garden is now producing bok choy, kale, broccoli, and pea pods, and we stored last year's carrots in buried coolers in the ground, we have had fresh vegetables on our plates since December. We'll likely do the same this coming fall. Kind of neat, isn't that, Charlie?
Yeah, that's great. It's nice to hear success stories like that, especially growing tomatoes through the winter. It really gives you hope that, you know, even in a small space in a room with some grow lights, you can grow some nice produce so you can have that fresh taste all year round.
Yeah, and if it's better than what you're going to buy in the store, even if it's not quite as good as the summer, the wonderful summer tomatoes, that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, that's really nice to have that.
Judy,
wow, great.
Yeah, Judy's on the line with us from St. George. Hi, Judy. What's your question?
Hi. Thank you. I'm calling because although my potato plants have always done well in the past, this year I have a couple stems where the leaves completely wilted. And when I looked at the base of the stem, it was brown and rotten. So I actually have two questions. One, though I don't see a lot of problem on the other other potato plants, should I do something about them? And two, these are in raised beds. If this, whatever it is coming from the soil, which I assume it is, what do I do? Is my raised bed no good forever?
Well, yeah, it is cause for concern because there is a disease called late blight, which attacks tomatoes and potatoes. And without seeing the foliage that you talked about, it's hard to really know if that's what you had. But you might want to contact the UVM Extension service, the plant pathology office, and just get an idea of that, or even just go online and Google late blight on potatoes to see if the symptoms that you see are similar to what you have in your bed. If they are, then yes, that is cause for concern because that's something that will spread through the whole potato bed and tomatoes if you have those too. If it's been a while since you saw that damage, a while being maybe a week or two, and nothing has happened since then, it's probably not that. It's probably more something related to just a rot that's happening down at the soil level because of the weather, or maybe you've been mulching them or something that's holding a lot of moisture there. And I wouldn't be too concerned about it. But it's definitely worth checking out what late blight on potatoes looks like and make sure that's not what you have in your case.
So speaking of potatoes, Bonnie writes, my potato plants are huge and beautiful. Does this mean I will get lots of potatoes or will they be all tops, tiny tubers?
Well, it sounds like a good promise, doesn't it? The bigger plants, you know, these tubers. But really the size of the tubers has a lot to do with moisture. So with all this drought we've been having, it's been very dry, very hit or miss with the thunderstorms. It's really important that you're watering regularly and watering and mulching and hilling up the potatoes. That way, the more moisture that's consistently around those tubers, they're modified stems, actually, in the soil, the bigger the spuds you're going to get come harvest time in September.
Okay, good to know. So you don't have to look at the leaves and wonder, what does that mean about the tubers? It's more moisture than leaf.
Exactly. It is good that she has big plants that are sending a lot of energy down there. But without the moisture, you're going to get a lot of small spuds.
Okay, got it. Paul is calling in from Concord, Vermont. Paul, go for it. Your turn.
Hi, I'm calling about flea beetles that are decimating my kale and cabbage to some extent. I've tried neem oil, I've tried food grade diatomaceous earth, and someone suggested dish soap and water. None of that seemed to work, although I have to say in the last few days and we've had a bit more rain, they don't seem to be around as much.
What do you think, Charlie?
Well, those would have been my solutions. The diatomaceous earth in particular seems to work with me when I have flea beetles. Flea beetles are, as he was mentioning, something that's more of an early season kind of pest. And then once their life cycle kind of progresses, you don't see them as much by midsummer. So there might be some hope here that they are kind of done with their cycle, their adult cycle, where they're doing all the damage, little holes, shotgun-like holes in the leaves. And they're moving on. And hopefully then your kale or your greens will start growing up strong again. It wouldn't hurt to give them a little shot of nitrogen at this point. So some fish emulsion, for example, some alfalfa meal, something that's a nitrogen source that the plants can take up pretty readily and start really outgrowing the infestation.
So Charlie, last week on Vermont Edition, we did an interview about chipmunks and why there are so many more chipmunks this year than last year. And it turns out it's a nefarious strategy by the trees, which I find fascinating because the trees in one year will have a scarcity of mast, you know, the nuts that mm-hmm. chipmunks need, and try to sort of starve out their predators, and then the next year have an abundance of crops, and so that there's no way these weakened chipmunks can eat them all. So we're seeing this, like, you know, back and forth between the species. But Anne in Stratford wrote in and said, I listened to your story last week on chipmunks and was disappointed that no one addressed the issue of preventing them from taking all the bulbs out of the garden. I have nothing left for next spring. So, Anne, this is your moment. We're going to talk chipmunks here with Charlie. And, Charlie, let me read you a few more comments that we've gotten about chipmunks.
Okay.
Because, as we learned, there are a ton of them this year. So Tammy in Hanover, New Hampshire says, the hot summer has been great for my tomato plants, but the vast chipmunk armies are threatening. They're already digging holes all over my raised beds and containers. Annoying, but not fatal yet. I'm concerned that if I don't get this under control, though, they'll eat the ripening tomatoes right off the vine before I can get to them. Of interest is that the only containers they haven't touched are my two potted citrus trees, which makes me think they're repelled by lemon and lime oils. I've also enlisted my five-year-old's help in sprinkling the developing tomato clusters with cayenne pepper in the hopes that they don't like strong spices. What else can I do that won't hurt kids and pets? Lynn in Essex says, I know chipmunks are prolific this year, and I usually love to watch their antics and generally find them very engaging. But they are decimating my flower gardens, eating the roots and buds from the lilies, the buds from the dahlias, the roots from the irises, and the crunchy stems of my hostas. I stopped feeding them when I realized the problem, but they continue to burrow, make holes everywhere, and munch away day and night. I've tried a spray that is supposedly taken up by the plant and renders it unpleasant, to absolutely no effect. What do I do to get rid of them, or at least halt their banquet in a humane manner? Lynn has a dog, so doesn't want to do anything that might hurt the dog. I'm not done yet, Charlie. Anne in Stratford says, I listened to the story last week on chipmunks. That's who we heard from, wants to know about bulbs. And Bill says, I live in the Clarendon neighborhood of Montpelier, and I'm having problems with, for sure, chipmunks. And then Bill might have other critters that that he's worried about, too, but says, I've seen the chipmunk who has made its home under my deck with at least three entrances into its den. How do I relocate these creatures or limit the damage to my garden and the potted pepper plants? Oh boy, Charlie.
Wow.
What can people do about chipmunks?
Well, a good thing about people being at home more during these times is that we're more observant and we are seeing what's causing a lot of the problems, which in this case are chipmunks. They're all over the place. I won't go into it because I did listen to your story about the chipmunks. Very good story. And really fascinating how the populations ebb and flow. So I won't go into any of that. We'll just focus
right
on the garden.
Yeah. Let's get to the garden, the important part.
To the garden, the important part. Okay. So chipmunks. Yeah, you could try fencing. I would say that wire mesh material that I was talking about earlier in the show, the micro mesh, which is a little heavier duty than a row cover. But you're going to have to be really careful about it because you're going to have to sink it into the ground a bit so that they don't tunnel underneath that. But the idea is that a lot of these little rodents, little chipmunks, don't have long attention spans. So if it takes a while for them to get somewhere, they're not going to really work for it. They'll just go on to the next bed or something else to eat. So that would be one possibility. You can do that. There are repellents out there. So the number of people have mentioned different repellents that you could use. The one that I've used pretty successfully for deer and for rabbit is called Plant Skid. It's SKYDD. Unfortunately, I think a lot of stores have sold out of it because of the pandemic. It's hard to get products of certain things. But if you can find it, it's a pretty effective material. It is made from slaughterhouse waste, basically blood meal. Hmm. So it's a really strong smell to it when you first put it out, but then it dissipates quickly. If you do have animals, especially dogs, will get very excited when you first put it out. So you might want to just keep them away for a day or so. But once it dissipates for those animals, but it stays there for the wild creatures that are around. So that's a possibility as well. And then the third one is
Does that work
on
other than just chipmunks, or is it mostly the small rodents that it's going to work on?
Well, I think it's when you look at the label, it talks about deer and rabbits, woodchucks, things of that nature. But I think it's worth a try on something even smaller.
Okay.
It's a pretty harmless product. The third one is one that I've tried a little bit for rodents, as it seems to have worked. Rodents got into my greenhouse, so I started doing this. And I got this idea from my wife, Wendy, who's using it in her car where she gets mice going into her car. And that's taking cotton balls and then putting some peppermint oil on them. And you just stick them around wherever the little chipmunks are like to go, or if they have holes. I think one of the listeners talked about the dens underneath the deck. You know, stick some underneath there too. They hate the smell. It's just a real strong essence of smell of peppermint, and that usually kind of drives them away. So I think you could try those types of things. and see what you can do. But short of that, there's not a lot else. They're tricky little critters, and they're hard to do anything else with.
So maybe just give over your garden to the chipmunks this year, Charlie?
It could be that you're really supporting local farmers this year.
Dan is calling in from Chittenden with something else that got into his greenhouse. Hi, Dan. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I've got a 14 by 20 greenhouse off the front of my place, and I have a nasty, nasty grasshopper problem. I've moved all the plants out, and I closed the doors, and I recorded temperatures over 140, and they're still there. It even melted plant pots, but they're still there. And I've ordered a Nosema Fang from online, and for whatever reason, they're not shipping. And the other thing I wanted to bring up, chipmunks make great pet treats when they're frozen.
Okay.
So there's a tip for what you can do with your chipmunks. And, you know, I'll have to look up. I know there's squirrel season in Vermont. I don't know what the rules are around harvesting chipmunks in the state of Vermont, but Dan says they're great pet treats. Okay, so but to the grasshopper invasion, it sounds like Dan's gone to extremes. Charlie, what else could he do?
Well, yeah, he has gone to extremes, and those are things that I would have done. I would think that the extreme heat, even though grasshoppers seem to be able to withstand heat, 140 degrees is really hot, that would really set them back. The noceum that he mentioned is a parasite of the grasshopper larvae, so I'm not sure that's really going to help too much to get them out there. I think the other alternative would be doing some kind of spray. Since it is a greenhouse, it's an enclosed environment, you can do a stronger kind of spray that would go after things like leaf hoppers and grasshoppers. You could try that spinosad I mentioned before. Because you've enclosed the greenhouse, it wouldn't be harmful to pollinators, and see if that helps. And if you can somehow use that to knock down the population and then hopefully get to the noceum, will eventually be shipped to you, spread that around so you can kill anything that's been going to be coming back up from a larvae form. So that's the best thing I could think of as far as taking care of those grasshoppers.
Wow, that's, yeah, interesting problem. I'm sorry you're having it, Dan, but thanks for the question and for the advice on chipmunks. Charlie, I got something interesting for you. At least I found it interesting. You might know the answer right away, but I was a little stumped by this. Carol in Brattleboro says, many years ago, I got some poppy seeds from a neighbor, and over the years, they have self-sown in different places, but have been happiest in the vegetable garden. They were always a bright salmon pink, but in the last few years, they have started coming out in lighter shades, tending to lavender. So I'm wondering if the change of color is due to the pH of the soil or some other factor. They are lovely. The blooms only last a few days, but continue blooming right up to the frost. I've noticed that the colors seem to get more intense as the weather cools. And Carol sent us a picture of a beautiful purple, lavendery colored poppy. So what about this, Charlie? It's really neat.
Well, those poppies, those bread seed poppies that she's talking about, are beautiful, and they cross really readily. So they'll cross amongst themselves. We've had a beautiful little section of under one of those rose plants that we just let go to seed. And this year it had everything from pink ones to red ones to singles and doubles and lavender and purple. It was just a whole smorgasbord of different colored poppies. So that's not unusual that she's seeing the colors changing a little bit just from the natural crossing. It could also have to do with sun levels. You know, you get cloudier summers, you'll get more vibrant, deeper colors than really hot, dry summers like we're having so far, where the colors are going to be a little more washed out. And those cooler temperatures will actually affect that color too. So I don't think it's so much the soil that she's growing, but more the other weather conditions that are happening and the natural crossing that's going on with the poppies.
It's neat. I would love to see the purple poppies. We only have a few, the bright red, sort of ready orange color, and I love them because they remind me of my childhood. But I would love it if mine would self-sow. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, they'll tell you where they're happiest. Just like she said, they're in the vegetable garden, and that's what we found around our house. Some places, though, they won't do well at all. Other places, they'll thrive. And you just let them find those places, and you don't have to do anything. Just thin them out a little bit in the spring.
Charlie, we've been hearing on the radio today about heat warnings throughout Vermont, and we were talking a little bit earlier about how it's been a hot and relatively dry early growing season. Do you have advice for gardeners related to the weather that we've been seeing so far?
Yeah, drink a lot of fluids.
Always good advice.
And wear a hat. That's the thing to do. Yes, keep things watered. So watering is really key. You know, when things are first coming out of the ground, little seedlings of carrots and beets and beans and other kinds of things you're growing from seed, it's important to water during these kind of conditions daily. Because the roots are small, they're right on the soil surface, that's going to dry out really quickly with the sun and the wind that we've been getting. So watering daily for those kinds of plants is really important. Once your plants are established, though, your tomatoes, your zinnias, your whatever you're growing, trees, shrubs, then you want to water infrequently and deeply. And you want to make sure you water so that the water soaks down a good 8 inches into the ground. And the question I always get is like, how do you know how long that is? And the simple solution is to stand there and water for a minute or two, you know, time it a little bit. Go do something else. Come back about a half hour later and dig down. And if you can dig down and see that the water has seeped down 8 inches into the soil, then you know how long it takes to water your soil in that situation. So kind of use that as a rule of thumb when you're watering. You know, watering deeply, maybe 3 times or so a week, and down to 8 inches is going to be much better for those plants than watering shallowly every day.
Good advice. And I would recommend listening to a podcast, maybe VPR's daily podcast, The Frequency, while you water. That's how I pass the time when I'm watering the garden.
There you go. Yeah.
Richard says, after 40 years of gardening in Orford, New Hampshire, I have a pest I had never even heard of. Four-lined plant bugs. They are doing serious damage to basil, eggplant, and some peppers. I've read that their work is usually finished by this time, but they're still around. Where did they come from, and how can I send them back?
That's the question we have for so many pests. Where do they come from? Four-lined plant bugs have been around. It's not like they're a new pest. They've been around for a while. And they attack a variety of things, as he was mentioning there. As far as sending them back, I think because they're a plant bug, kind of similar to a number of other pests that we've been talking about, some of the organic sprays would work on them, like the spinosad. But then, of course, there's always a caveat about pollinators and honeybees. So being very careful about using that kind of spray. If you want to try a less severe spray, you could try something like neem oil and see if that helps with them. But, you know, picking the adults as you see them and you're working around plants and seeing any of them, and I'm trying to identify the eggs. I'm not familiar with the eggs off the top of my head if they're laid singly or in groups underneath the leaves, but that's something to find out about, too. That's another way to kind of reduce that population.
What do you do with the bugs? I mean, we talked about the pleasure of popping the eggs sometimes. It's a little bit makes people sometimes more squirmy to think about killing a bug between their fingers.
Yeah, so you can always just take the bug and drop it into a little pail or a little dish of soapy water, and that usually would kill it. So, for example, Japanese beetles are out, and we have some, but this is not a big year so far for Japanese beetles. But that's our morning routine, is going out into the grapes and the raspberries and just knocking them into soapy water, and that kills them.
Well, Loretta has a question about Japanese beetles, and she lives in Linden Center and says, the beetles are just starting to come out in the Northeast Kingdom, and I'm hand-picking them daily from rugosa roses and raspberry plants. In the past, I've used Japanese beetle traps that use pheromones to trap them. These beetle traps work really well, but I worry I'm attracting beetles from all my neighbors. What are your thoughts on these beetle traps? And Loretta says, I tried neem on the rugosa rose in the past, but noticed the bees stopped going to the roses, so I don't use that anymore.
Yeah. Well, I would give your neighbors the Japanese beetle traps as a gift. And
I might along with some zucchini.
Right? And some zucchini, yes. No, the Japanese beetle traps have gotten a bad rap because people have used them not properly. They put them right next to the plants they're trying to protect, for example. And all that does, as she noted, is that they attract them into your yard, and then they'll have a little snack before they jump into the trap. So the key is to keep the trap away from the plants you're trying to protect, at least a couple hundred feet or so away. So the best way to use Japanese beetle traps is to use them as perimeter traps. Put them around the edge of your property. Usually in areas where the wind is naturally blowing. So in the summer, we get a lot of southern winds. So maybe put it on the south side of your property. And as the winds blow those Japanese beetles in, they're going to hit the trap before they hit anything good to eat. And that would be the most effective way to use them.
Got it. All right. Let's go to Linda, who's calling in from Middlesex. Hi, Linda.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we hear you loud and clear.
Okay, great. Thanks for taking my call. Charlie, I have this sweet little blue hydrangea that someone gave me, and put it in the sort of northern part of my eastern-facing garden, and it looks as healthy as can be, but it's not blooming. and it's been there for a couple of years. Is there anything I can do to enhance the blooms, or do blue hydrangeas not do well in Vermont?
Yes. So there was a whole new line of blue hydrangeas that came out probably 10 or 20 years ago now, called the Endless Summer line of blue hydrangeas. And the thing that made them unique compared to other blue hydrangeas is that they would bloom on the new wood, meaning that most blue hydrangeas will bloom on stems or stalks or branches that overwinter. And then next spring, the leaves come out from those branches and they form flowers and you get beautiful blue flowers. But unfortunately, in Vermont, it's too cold in the winter for a lot of these blue hydrangeas, so they would die back to the ground. Endless Summer solved that problem by saying, even if they die back to the ground, what comes out of the root system, the new growth, should also flower for you. So those were a plant that everyone was very excited about, but it had mixed results. But they have different iterations, different groups that have come out since then that are much better at repeat flowering and flowering consistently in Vermont. One thing you can do, though, with your old plant, if you have it, or get some of the newer varieties, I have one called Bloomstruck, for example, that does really well, is to protect them in the winter so you can get some of those older stems surviving the cold temperatures. And the way to do that is in around Thanksgiving, maybe early December, get some wood chips or bark mulch and bury the plant that you have about a foot deep in those. And what that'll do is it'll protect those lower stems, the lower parts of those stems, from the winter cold and the wind. So that next spring, when you remove that, you'll have some live buds there that will form the flowers. And if you have an Endless Summer that does bloom, but blooms, say, in October, that's what's been happening. So by putting that wood chips around there, you'll get blooms each year, and you'll get them a little earlier in the summer.
You know, I'm with Linda. My hydrangeas were there when I moved in, and they never bloom. And I've tried, like, you know, cutting off all of the old wood on one and not on the other to try to see which will do better. We're doing that this year. And no matter what, nothing, it never blooms at all. Maybe time to just dig it up, Charlie.
I think it's time to get a replacement.
Maybe it's just time for me to move. I've got too many things not blooming.
Oh, maybe that too.
Let's go to Cassandra in Montpelier. Hi, Cassandra.
Hi.
Go right ahead.
Oh, sure. Hi. So I'm calling because I actually have two gardens. One is raised beds in my backyard, and I also have a plot in a community garden. And in the raised beds, I'm seeing rodent holes. And in the community garden, we have a problem with voles that are damaging a lot of people's plants. And so we've had a lot of long email discussions about how to manage the voles, also given that the community garden is located within a nature center.
Hmm.
So we have we can't kill them and definitely can't use poison. So some people want to trap them, and I guess that would mean trap and release. We've talked about removing debris because the garden also has in the invasive snake worm. We have a rule where...
Cassandra, I'm going to stop you because we want to get an answer and we're going to run out of time before Charlie gets to answer before the show ends. And I'm glad that we got you in so that you and your community garden can get an answer. What should she do about the voles, Charlie?
Ah, the voles, yes. Trapping them or releasing them is not a good idea. That is generally not recommended by the wildlife groups in the state wildlife group in particular, because it's a death sentence for most animals. They get disoriented and they'll just die in the wild. So I think some kind of barrier. So if you have raised beds, for example, in the community gardens, you might want to put some hardware cloth underneath the raised beds. It would require moving the bed, you know, digging out the soil, putting the hardware cloth and put it back on. That's kind of a longer term solution. For right now, try some of that peppermint oil that I mentioned about for the chipmunks. And put it on cotton balls and put it around areas where you see their activity and see if that helps.
All right. So good luck with that, Cassandra, and good luck to everybody with all of your garden issues this year. Wish I could eat from all of your gardens or see your beautiful flowers. Charlie Nardozzi is a horticulturist, author, and contributor to All Things Gardening here on VPR, which airs Sunday mornings at 9:35. Charlie, happy summer. Nice to talk with you.
Happy summer, Jane. Take care.